I was thinking about it this morning, that actually the happiest people in Washington about Kyrsten Sinema becoming independent are the former aides to Joe Manchin, who now are lobbyists, who are suddenly back in demand again. Because for 48 hours, they were all of a sudden not that useful to anybody.
I think she, and you could say this about Bernie Sanders too, these are people who are like in the Groucho Marx club. Yeah, they don't want to be part of any club that will have them. I mean, I think, I was thinking about,
it's very on
you
brand.
Know, she is, it's so on brand. This is a woman who wears a ring that says literally, fuck off.
Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Evan Osnos, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Susan Glasser and Jane Mayer. Hi to you both.
Hi, Evan.
Hey, Evan.
There is a lot to talk about this week. We've got the Georgia runoff, Kyrsten Sinema becoming an independent, a new primary calendar, perhaps, for the Democrats, and the criminal conviction of the Trump Organization for tax fraud. But I think we have to start, really, with Donald Trump calling to, quote-unquote, terminate the Constitution. He would like to be reinstated somehow as president, or at a minimum, have what he describes as the 2020 election redone. Makes it sound like an interior decoration project. It goes without saying this is not only a fantasy on his part, but it is really a dangerous one. Even by Trump standards, this is the farthest that he's ever gone in public. But it also feels like something new for the country. Can you put this statement in some context for us?
Well, that's right. It's hard in the scale of Donald Trump outrages to take a moment and pause and contemplate any individual one. This one is worth contemplating. We're with the other day, the historian John Meacham, and actually I asked him, he's just got a new book out on Abraham Lincoln, and I asked him, is there any precedent, even in the context of the Civil War, for a current president, an aspiring president, a past president, to directly take on the Constitution? Even in essentially the Confederate Rebellion, that did not happen. Even the Confederates, when they broke away from the Union, what did they do with the Constitution? They cut and pasted it and basically copied it, and their Constitution was a mirror image of the U.S. Constitution. They weren't in rebellion against the Constitution. They simply wanted power. They wanted the power to exercise and execute the laws themselves. And what's remarkable about Donald Trump is that, you know, he would put in writing a statement like this. And it essentially seems to me like it's more evidence for a future legal case against Donald Trump than certainly it's evidence of a man campaigning for another go at the White House. He's 3 weeks now into his candidacy. And I have to say, I wrote this. I mean, it's like Donald Trump is the only announced candidate. At this point, he's running against himself and losing.
And running against the Constitution, evidently.
I mean, I'm curious, when you spoke with John Meacham, who's such has just sort of an encyclopedic historical recall, what did he say, though, about Lincoln suspending habeas corpus during the Civil War? Not that we're in a civil war, and not that this is anything that was front of mind for Donald Trump, but we have had sort of some touchy moments.
Well, that's right, touchy moments, but no one who's frontally attacked and said they are, in essence, in a state of opposition to the Constitution. There have been many examples of presidents. Lincoln's is probably the most famous, but it's not the only one. Presidents who are forced into what they see as competing choices between different parts of the Constitution. And, you know, the president's war powers in that case versus the question of the civil liberties guaranteed by the Constitution. So, you know, there have been many moments that have tested and challenged the framing of, you know, a president's actions, but no president, and certainly not Lincoln, who would define their actions as explicitly opposing the Constitution. And that's what's so remarkable about this moment. And by the way, very consistent with Donald Trump, who never, even when he was president of the United States, you swear an oath to protect, uphold, defend the Constitution. Donald Trump never knew what was in the Constitution. The history of it is remarkable.
He did once make reference to, of course, the venerable Article 12, which is so elusive that even scholars can't identify it. Yeah,
I mean, the perennial question, every day, everybody asks himself the same things. Has he gone too far? Is he going to, you know, lose his support at this point? He is actually, this particular statement, along with his dining with a neo-Nazi or two, has gotten him some criticisms from pretty high-ranking party members. Mitch McConnell didn't use Trump's name, but basically said anyone who says that they want to suspend the Constitution is not going to get elected president. And we saw some other party leaders, John Cornyn, Senator, and John Thune, Senator, major Republican senators, and you know, Senator Toomey, who is outgoing, another important Republican senator. These guys are speaking out and distancing themselves from Trump, but does it really matter?
The only thing I wonder about is whether the Constitution is one area that it's treated as this almost like a secular
sacred
Bible.
Yeah.
And it, and in some ways, he may have mixed his metaphors here, that by going after that, he thought he was going after the establishment, but in fact, he was going after the thing that is treated like a bumper sticker by so many of his base. Do you think this has any real staying power beyond the immediate? Does it have any real impact in the long run in terms of politics, democracy?
Well, look, I think it's important to look at where is this flood of criticism of Trump coming from? People like Mitch McConnell, those senators, they are generally the Trump skeptical wing of the Republican Party. What I haven't seen yet is a large tide of the slavishly pro-Trump faction of the elected Republican officials, the people in the House and the Senate who have been kind of the Trump hallelujah chorus. They have not started to break with Trump. That would be a real indication of a major shift. Remember that Mitch McConnell hasn't even spoken with Donald Trump since the 2020 election. They had a big rift over it. Toomey was one of the handful of Republican senators who voted to convict Donald Trump in his second impeachment trial. There is unquestionably, a sort of air letting out of the balloon. I have not, detected this level of optimism among Trump's committed enemies, of which there are many here in Washington in both parties, about, you know, this being the end of the kind of long Trump run. There is that feeling that there's a shift in the moment. But remember that right now he's still the only candidate who's running. And one of the reasons he announced this campaign, which certainly is off to a catastrophically bad start, but one of the reasons he did it was to try to muscle out of the race to scare off any other contenders. So we'll see if Ron DeSantis or any of the others actually runs against him. Because in the end, in this system, you have to beat somebody with somebody. Now, Trump, again, as I said, he's doing a good job of beating himself. His mouth is a formidable opponent to his aspiration.
I mean, I think it's interesting that Paul Gosar, who is one of the few congressmen who came out and supported the idea of suspending or tearing up the Constitution, he then deleted the tweet. He's a Republican from Arizona. So it's gotten to the point where supporting Trump requires even the most committed Trump supporter in the House to delete the tweet, which shows you that even the fringe is kind of a little bit worried about this. And going back to why his supporters support him, they're supporting him because they think he's strong. He's a strong man. If he looks weak, if his candidates that he's backed don't win, if he can't raise money, if he looks like a loser, which is his greatest fear in life, I think you begin to see him lose altitude.
What about the fact that this week did not only include him going to war against the Constitution, but also the fact that two Trump Organization corporate entities were found guilty on all counts of criminal tax fraud and falsifying records? Alan Weisselberg, who's the former CFO, is facing now months in prison. To what extent, Jane, do you think Trump himself is impacted by this, entangled by this?
Oh, my God. He just, you know, I was thinking he's down there in Mar-a-Lago. He's quite isolated. He hasn't left it very often. I mean, almost not at all. And it's beginning to have the feel of like Alcatraz. I mean, he's got all of these legal problems. By one count, I mean, it depends how you categorize things. But one count, I came up with six different ongoing major criminal investigations against him. You've got the Mar-a-Lago documents case. You've got the fake electors case, the January 6th insurrection case. Those are the three major prongs of the Justice Department's investigation. You've got two investigations in New York, one from the New York Attorney General, one from the New York DA, into his business practices and his tax practices. And as you say, he was just his business was just convicted. His chief financial officer's on his way to prison. And then you've got the Georgia case about, you know, give me the extra votes to sort of fix the election win in 2020. So you've got, he is surrounded and under siege by legal problems. But the thing about Trump is this isn't so unusual for him. You go back to his, look at his biography. He is almost throughout his entire life been in legal fights. And one of his tactics that he learned from, I think, from Roy Cohen, who was one of his early legal advisors, is delay, delay, delay. He stretches these things out. They just keeps kicking the can down the road and trying his best. So you see in the documents case, you come up with like ridiculous legal strategies that just keeps him out of being convicted.
Well, he did it on the January 6th committee. You know, they subpoenaed him and he more or less dragged out the process. But Susan, that doesn't mark the end of it for him, right? We're getting to the point now where the January 6th committee is going to make criminal referrals. It's not exactly clear who they're going to name or what the crimes are that they're going to spell out. But what are you hearing? What do you think is likely to come out?
Well, that's right. I mean, look, it's legally speaking, it doesn't matter if they make a criminal referral of Donald Trump. There's already this grand jury investigation. There's now a special counsel who's been appointed since he announced his run again for the White House. So he was already under this investigation, and the Justice Department is going to make whatever decision it's going to make. I think there are a number of other figures in Trump's orbit who risk being under the lens of the Justice Department now for false statements they may have given the committee, perjury, things like that. And there's a long list of people who face real risk, who are key lieutenants of Donald Trump in terms of orchestrating this remarkable effort to overturn the results of a legitimate election. Talk about challenging the Constitution. The basic principle enshrined in the Constitution is the peaceful transfer of power, the democratic small d process. And people like Mark Meadows, Trump's former White House chief of staff, people like his advisor on and off again, Roger Stone, those people were central to the plot as it emerged after the election. They were the people who were facilitating Trump's challenge to the election, who were helping to orchestrate the events that unfolded on January 6th. And there remains this important connection, which I personally think is the key question about whether that January 6th report that we're going to get very soon before Christmas, we're told, will that January 6th report illuminate any further the key question of Trump's contacts and those of the White House's contacts with those who ultimately stormed the Capitol.
But some of the people that you just mentioned who might be charged, for instance, or might be subject to a criminal referral, are they going to flip on him? Are any of these the type who are going to sort of pull a Michael Cohen and suddenly come decide that they want to put themselves first and turn on Donald Trump? Or are they the ones who are going to stay mum and kind of mind the omerta of the whole operation?
Well, it depends what levers of force are brought to bear against them.
I don't think they're going to flip because of the January 6th Congressional Committee, but they're facing a much tougher situation from the Justice Department. I mean, in a way, interesting and important, though, that conviction of the Trump Organization is in New York. I think that looking at the flip side of it, what is really kind of amazing is that Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial officer, did not flip on Trump. And under tremendous pressure, you know, and he will go to prison now, and he still has not sung a song about Donald Trump's involvement in rigging these tax problems. His daughter-in-law was Jennifer Weisselberg was somebody that I interviewed for a piece that I did. She was absolutely amazing character. She was divorced from his son, and she is actually at the root of many of these charges. She just came out and she walked into the prosecutors and said, she said basically, I have the ruby slippers, meaning, and here they are. I can take you to the Wizard of Oz.
Why?
And
why?
Yet he didn't break.
Why is that, Susan? Why do you think he stays alive?
You know, Donald Trump is very gifted at a certain kind of what you might call, personnel management, which is to say, obviously, he surrounds himself with a lot of conflict, a lot of chaos. He defines loyalty mostly as a one-way street, but he's been adept over time at eventually getting his way to characters, whether they're Mark Meadows or Weisselberg or, others who wouldn't have their positions except for him. He draws them into whatever his misdeeds are, right? He makes them culpable along with him at it. And I think it's an amazing story because the prosecutors in the closing arguments of this trial made it very clear. They actually told the jury Donald Trump knew all about this scheme. Trump, in fact, was a micromanager. It's a fascinating thing because the Trump Organization is not like a conventional company. There's no real board of directors. There's no real corporate accountability. It's certainly not a public company. And Donald Trump, he cared about the little details often more than he did other things. This is the kind of guy who would, be focused on the lighting in the Oval Office. He was focused on the cost of replacing the marble in the lobby at the Trump Tower, where his headquarters for the Trump Organization were. So he was extremely hands-on. And of course, he cared about money most of all. He personally signed the bonus checks at the Trump Organization. So the idea that this is some sort of separate corporate conviction, I think people need to understand that, when the Trump Organization is convicted, that's Donald Trump's.
Yes, yes, yes. We all know this, but yet, as Michael Cohen, his former sort of what consigliere, has said, Trump, for all of his sort of blunders, has an uncanny knack for figuring out how to keep his fingerprints off of things. And he would issue orders, Cohen has told me, saying things like, well, you know what to do.
Yeah.
And of course, they did know exactly what he wanted, but it wouldn't be in writing. He doesn't use email. He would do it by implication.
But the collision is when his dedication to keeping his hands clean collides with his dedication to not spending money. And you saw that he personally arranged Alan Weisselberg's children's tuition. And that may be the thing ultimately that gets him in trouble. The Political Scene will be back in just a moment. Well, the other big news this week is Raphael Warnock winning in the Georgia Senate runoff, which solidified Democrats' control of the Senate. This was an incredibly expensive race, very hard-fought race. What do you think in the end allowed him to win, Susan?
I think you were the one who called candidate quality the euphemism of the year. And he was running against what even Georgia's Republican lieutenant governor called one of the worst Republican candidates in the history of our party. That's a direct quote. And it speaks to, Republicans in the state who just reelected their governor, Brian Kemp, by, I think it was 7 points in the general election. They just couldn't pull the lever for Herschel Walker, number one. Number two, Raphael Warnock. He's now run and won 5 elections in Georgia in just the last couple of years. A remarkable feat. He's an extremely talented politician who made a decision that Walker was such a flawed candidate that he was going to work to appeal to independents and even some Republicans as well as Democrats in his campaign this year. That turned out to be a very smart decision.
It's remarkable, actually, how close it was. Well, I mean, given all that.
In the first place, people in Georgia were complaining that maybe the problem was turnout. But the second thoughts, what it's turned out to be is that the turnout was pretty good even on the Republican side, but Republicans split their tickets in various races in order to try to, they couldn't get themselves, as Susan says, to pull the lever for Herschel Walker.
Well, it's a story about the suburbs, which of course has some national implications, right? What's amazing is that Walker did extremely well, actually, in the staunchly Republican red rural areas of the state. But there's been a dramatic, almost generational shift in the voting patterns in especially the Atlanta suburbs. Over the last decade, you've seen just an incredible demographic and political shift in those places. And that's one of the reasons, of course, why Joe Biden won the presidency, why Democrats managed to take back the Senate and the House in 2018. And I think it shows that there's a different kind of battleground in American politics that's not so much geographic anymore as it is sort of cultural and educational. The biggest dividing line in American politics today is not even so much where you live, although if you live in a big city, you're far, far, far more likely to be a Democrat than if you don't. But the real dividing line is education and whether you have a college degree or not. And that certainly proved to be the case in Georgia.
Somebody described it as the focus is now not only on soccer moms, but on Peloton dads. I mean, there is this the kind of class education rift, exactly as you were describing.
I mean, Peloton, come on, Pelotons are really expensive. You're really talking top money there then.
It's
beyond my, but we do not have a Peloton in my family, I just would like to say. But
Jane is a thrifty New Englander at heart.
I am. But let me just also say, I think we need to give some credit to Stacey Abrams, who did not win her election running for governor of Georgia, but who I think did an unbelievable job of creating on the ground sort of operation of turnout of many Democrats who had not voted before with her Fair Fight organization.
Absolutely.
And it's kind of, I mean, it's perplexing to me that she didn't win and that the male candidates did, but who she helped Warnock for some reason didn't even have her there at his side at events. But, you know, somehow Kemp came out of this, the governor who was reelected, came out of it looking like a moderate, which he's not. And Stacey Abrams couldn't somehow defeat him.
One of the interesting pieces that's been going around this week is that historically, the arrangement of the Georgia runoff system was designed to disenfranchise black voters, right? And it was created, in effect,
absolutely,
to make it harder
it's
for
like a Jim
candidate.
Crow throwback, and it's still in existence there.
Well, that's right. I think that, you know, Abrams became a polarizing figure. She was a talking point and a lightning rod for national Republicans over the last few years since her gubernatorial run, and that made her essentially unacceptable to the independents and Republican-leaning independents who ultimately provided a key part of the margin of victory for Warnock. And, you know, one of the issues was Republicans are kind of masters at the national level of this whataboutism. And they used Abrams as an example, many people would say unfairly, but they said, you know, that Abrams's failure to concede her initial campaign against Brian Kemp for governor was somehow tantamount, which of course it wasn't, to what Donald Trump did in the aftermath of the 2020 election.
I gotta wonder about the sexism, though, also, I have to say, and misogyny. I mean, you know, it's just, it's much harder for any woman to get elected, and especially for a black woman to get elected, I think.
Yeah.
I agree.
One more twist on all this happened just this morning. Kyrsten Sinema announcing that she's an independent, which knocks control of the Senate back to a 50-49-1 divide. She says she's going to stay allied with the Democrats. She's going to, as she put it, not change her values and behavior, which is code word for votes. But what does this actually mean, do you think? What is the practical impact? This was described in the usual Washington cliche as a bombshell and so on. But I'm not actually convinced that it is unless she really departs from what she's promising. What do you think?
Yeah, I think electorally it may matter more for her than it does in the day-to-day running of the U.S. Senate. She already was a thorn in the side of Democrats. She already spent a lot of time across the aisle working with Republicans. That was sort of her brand, was a kind of cantankerous independence already, a contrarianism. Joe Manchin got a lot more of the attention at times in the first 2 years of the Biden presidency, but Sinema was probably just as much of a challenge for Democrats to manage. It's very interesting. She's actually the chair right now of two subcommittees.
And she gets to hold on to those.
And she seems to want to hold on to those. And that will be very interesting. I think that she's trying to portray this in Washington as not a sort of blowing up of the regular order. And Jane's point, I think, is very well taken, that Democrats are going to maintain their control on committees, it appears, which will enable them to move through nominees at a much quicker and more efficient pace than they were able to do in the first 2 years.
It just shows you how incredibly important that Georgia win was for the Democrats. It makes the math such that if anything happens to any Democratic senator, mm-hmm. they're in a very bad position.
So Which goes back to our previous topic of gerontocracy.
Exactly. Or any kind of terrible accident that would befall someone, whatever, it's going to complicate the life of Chuck Schumer, but it's workable still, I think, for him.
The last big question, which is a really contentious one, which is about the shape of the Democratic Party primary calendar. Jane, as you know, President Biden asked the Democratic National Committee to move South Carolina forward in the primary calendar, making it the first on the schedule. It would be followed by Nevada, then New Hampshire, Georgia, and Michigan if this plan goes through. The argument being that voices of voters of color had been locked out early in the process when you began in places like Iowa and New Hampshire. Do you see this as the DNC as the party catching up to the changing demographics of the country, of the party? Do you think this is a plan that's going to go ahead?
I think it's a sign that Joe Biden is the head of the party. Hmm. South Carolina was the state that clinched the Democratic nomination for him, and he's rewarding it and putting it first.
I mean, Jim Clyburn, of course, very powerful congressman from South Carolina who made this key endorsement, which allowed Biden to then win the state, and the rest is history.
Absolutely. I mean, there are, I mean, that's the hard and fast politics behind this. But at the same time, Biden said that basically 99% of black voters in the Democratic Party had not had a chance to vote until South Carolina. And that, of course, makes no sense. Black voters are just the backbone of the Democratic Party. And people sometimes, you know, overlook that. And certainly their old primary schedule overlooked that because Iowa and New Hampshire are, you know, have many assets, but they are pretty short on voters of color. So this is a fix to that. What I've seen is people mostly support this within the Democratic Party, except for one thing that there's a fight over, which is actually the choice of South Carolina.
This is really interesting. An important op-ed that was written by Faz Shakir, who had managed Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2020, a progressive organizer, who actually came out against the decision to put South Carolina first on the schedule.
And he made some good points, I think. Well, his point was, okay, what is this schedule about? It's about trying to pick the strongest candidate and also about strengthening the party. And the first state gets a huge amount of money. I mean, you know, when we talk about how much money is going into politics, what are we talking about? It's pouring into TV stations locally and all kinds of other advertising in that area and organizing. And if you're going to put that kind of money into South Carolina, you want it to be an investment in winning the state. And what Shakir argued was the Democrats are not going to win South Carolina in the general election. So why are you picking a state that they're not going to win? He certainly didn't say that we should pick another white state. What he suggested was, how about North Carolina? How about Georgia, which we were just talking about? But again, South Carolina has a special spot in the heart of Joe Biden.
Well, that's right, Jane. I think that's really what this tells us is as much about Joe Biden and, again, the question, which is the question right now in Washington and in the country, is whether Joe Biden is going to run again for president. And the tea leaves have certainly indicated that he's leaning into it. He said that he's going to be sort of regrouping with his family and really kind of subjecting that to a actual gut check over the holidays after the midterm elections, when Democrats did much better than expected, beating history, if not fully keeping control of Congress. Biden said it was, quote, his intention to run again. And there was this very interesting, speaking of the tea leaves, I think the South Carolina primary thing was one example where you might say, wow, Biden is more leaning towards running. Another very interesting thing came out this week at the first state dinner of his presidency for Emmanuel Macron. Biden, supposedly Jill Biden, who was probably the most influential advisor to the president on this and other matters, was said to have told the French president that they were planning to run again. And Macron then had a toast at the head table to a successful Biden campaign, which is a fascinating example.
Do you have a source on the waitstaff or something?
You know, no, this was reported by the New York Times. And, you know, I do think it's interesting because is it the kind of anecdote that they wanted us to hear?
Right.
Now, by the way, the real gossip that I heard about the state dinner, and it was all the talk of Washington, had nothing to do with Joe Biden running again. It was that the food was so late in coming. They didn't sit down and eat dinner until 10:30 at night. People, and there were no hors d'oeuvres. Oh, my goodness. That, you know, the shock over the lack of hors d'oeuvres. I'm told that that culprit, not surprisingly, was the loquacious president himself who couldn't stop talking to people in the receiving line.
And then you can go late on a dinner for Spain, but not for France.
And you certainly don't skip hors d'oeuvres
for a French dinner. But there was U.S.-French relations.
And they ran out of glasses, I heard later. But I talked to somebody who went there and I said, you know, so were you unhappy about it? And he said, I hope I don't live long enough to be so spoiled that I'm unhappy at being invited to a state dinner.
Fair enough. One of the things I hear you saying is that as Joe Biden begins to make some of the preparations for a possible run, that this, let's remember, fairly canny, fairly experienced politician may have been working on something of a backroom deal here, perhaps, with Congressman Clyburn about how to make sure that things are arranged appropriately for him.
Well, look, I mean, you know, if you want to know why Joe Biden is president, the answer is Jim Clyburn in many key respects. So you don't have any more loyalty in politics than to the person who brung you to the table. And I think that that is a lot of the story here. But I want to inject just a tiny note of skepticism because I think Iowa is over for the Democrats. I'm not as convinced about New Hampshire. And I think that, you know, New Hampshire, it's literally enshrined in their state law that they have to be a week before any other state that has a comparable election. It is fundamental to their political identity as a state. And you have Democrats as well as Republicans who are sort of committed to that. And I somehow feel that New Hampshire is still going to get a shot at being the first in the nation primary.
I just saw some comments made by New Hampshire's governor, Republican Chris Sununu, of course, dumping all over South Carolina and saying, oh, it's just it's a state with crummy turnout where the bosses rule everything. And so they're not going to go without a fight. It's live free or die, and they'll die first before they let it go.
Well,
I agree with that.
It's baked into the identity there. All of us have been there during the primary season and seen how it's experienced. But, you know, there are always critics of New Hampshire, too. Mike Barnicle over the years has called it a pit stop, not a primary state. So the fur gets flying pretty quickly. What I think, though,
nobody's going to miss Iowa in February, though, I have to say.
I think Iowa lost it, honestly, by being so incredibly badly organized the last time around. I mean, they can't complain.
What we talked about earlier with Trump and what we're talking about now with Democrats is the sense that you have both parties trying to kind of break free of what has been the defining elements of their politics, either for the last 5 years, 7 years, or 40 years. And you get this feeling, and Susan, you hinted at it a moment ago, that we're at something of an inflection point. Do you feel as if actually we are beginning to see that the changing demographics, the attitudes, the personalities in the parties are pushing us out of the sclerosis that has been such a defining fact for the last few years?
Well, as always, Evan, you find an optimistic gloss on what may or may not be an optimistic moment in our politics. But I do think that, you know, Donald Trump was the end of something. Donald Trump was the end of this post-Cold War moment. Donald Trump and George W. Bush and actually Bill Clinton were three presidents all born in 1946 within a couple months of each other. Baby boomers. I think Biden has come in as almost a sort of interim figure at a moment of great change. So I don't know what's the name that we're going to give to this switch in American politics in the future, but I think history is going to look back and say, you know, that the Trump presidency and now this interregnum with Biden was at the beginning of a big, big shift in American politics.
God, I hope you're right. I'm usually the optimist, but I have a much more pessimistic view, which is that even without Trump, that it's not the end of something. It's the beginning, potentially, of Trumpism and this sort of move towards an anti-democratic, more authoritarian kind of movement in the country. and that DeSantis is standing by to pick up the mantle and run with it. And I thought that was a very funny line, actually, from Asa Hutchinson, the governor of Arkansas, who said, you know, that if DeSantis runs against Trump, it's going to be the first father-son primary. Because really, one seems to have spawned the other, and I don't see them going away.
Yeah, well, just to be clear, I don't see them going away either. But I think we may be stuck in a more authoritarian future where the liberal order that we all grew up in is under question as never before. That's why I'm saying it might not be a good transition, but a transition I think we're having nonetheless.
I think maybe it depends.
You're saying it's the end of the end of history.
The end of the end. Maybe it depends also whether what the Democrats come up with as an alternative, and we're sort of waiting to see because basically Biden is something from an earlier era, and so can the party invent itself for a new era?
We'll have to take it up next week. Jane, Susan, it is a pleasure to be with you, as always. Thank you.
Thank oh, my
you,
goodness.
Evan.
Thank you.
This has been The Political Scene. I'm Evan Osnos. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia and Chelsea Daniel. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown.